Why bank offshore? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Parking your money in Panama and other offshore tax havens isn't always illegal.
I'm sure in some cases people have reasons that are, you know, they're not committing crimes. But always you're looking to hide your wealth for one reason or another.
So, yeah, that bothers at least some wealth managers who help the super rich.
One of the guys I interviewed actually said, I tell all my coworkers, if I ever become like our clients, just shoot me.
And then an English village that was literally built around an ancient stone.
Everyone knows it's there. It's a historical spot. People come to visit it and to see it, and pagans come and worship there as well.
Problem is, the rock's in the middle of a road now. The story is today here on The World. Good to have you here today. Let's start with the Panama Papers, that massive document leak detailing how the wealthy and powerful hide their money. The leak claimed its first political victim today. The Prime Minister of Iceland resigned after the Panama Papers revelation that he and his wife own an offshore company. The scandal is causing a big enough stir that President Obama weighed in.
Tax avoidance is a big global problem. It's not unique to other countries. Because, frankly, there are folks here in America who are taking advantage of the same stuff. A lot of it's legal, but that's exactly the problem.
The president called on the Treasury Department to close tax loopholes to make it harder for companies to stash cash offshore. We're going to look at the Panama Papers from a couple of different angles today. First of all, they're not actual papers. They're electronic documents, more than 11 million of them. That's 2.6 terabytes of raw data. And right there, we wanted to know, how can we even make sense of so much data? Timothy McGrath is a digital editor in our newsroom. Tim, you've been digging into this side of the story, just the size alone of the data leak. Put that into context. What does 2.6 terabytes mean in terms of the magnitude of this leak and what's in it?
Right, Marco. So I would say that the size of the leak is one of the biggest stories about it. 2.6 terabytes, that's 2,600 gigabytes. So for a little bit of context, if you look at other major data leaks in recent history, you've got Edward Snowden's surveillance leaks. Those are around 60 gigabytes estimated to be. The WikiLeaks diplomatic cables sent to the State Department, those are around 1.7 gigabytes. So again, we're talking orders of magnitude larger.
It's huge.
Let me just throw a few numbers at you about what's inside those 2.6 terabytes. First of all, in terms of time, you've got 40 years of operations that it's covering. You've got 4.8 million emails. You've got 3 million database files. And you have around 2 million PDF documents. You know, also buried in there, you've got 214,000 different companies. So you've got connections also to around 140 politicians, close associates, 12 heads of state. So these are big numbers.
Data going back 40 years and including everything up until the end of 2015. So how did journalists make sense, any sense, out of all of this? Did someone read all 11.5 million documents of data?
Yeah, you just started page one, Marco, and start reading. No, the short answer to that is no. You know, this operation was really being headed up by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and they organized 400 journalists at around 109 different media organizations and spent a year digging into this giant cache. So it's a huge operation. Then there's also a sort of technological story happening here, because humans can't dig through this amount of data. Thank God we have computers. On the front end, the platform that journalists ended up actually using to dive into this data looked something like Google. So the computer would then help them dig into this sort of massive cache and start pulling out some of the network connections and start telling some of the stories or the sorts that you see in the headlines on your Twitter feed for the last 36 hours or so. And so we've barely scratched the surface of the data contained in this leak. Who knows what else is in there?
Yeah, more to come, no doubt. Tim McGrath with our digital team here at The World. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
So if you're ultra rich and looking to stash your billions in offshore accounts, you'll probably get some help doing it. And that's where wealth managers come in. My next guest is Brooke Harrington. She wanted to find out more about how these wealth managers work. So she decided to study and become one herself. And that, Harrington says, allowed her to enter their world.
Some of the people I interviewed, several of them in different countries, actually described their work as not just the technical task of evading the laws, but as social work for the rich. That was a direct quote from some of them. And a lot of their frustrations came with feeling that their clients were really kind of bad people, One of the guys I interviewed actually said, I tell all my coworkers, if I ever become like our clients, just shoot me.
What led him to say that? Was there one client that that person just felt was so kind of reprehensible that they just did not want to be them?
I think there were several of them. It took several of them to get him to that point. But he had just told me the story of working with some client in Monaco who warned him, the wealth manager, don't bring your wife to Monaco when you meet with us, because my friends have this social tradition where they try to steal each other's wives. So don't bring any woman you care about to our meetings.
Why do wealth managers do this work then?
A lot of reasons. That particular gentleman who said, just shoot me, said he really enjoys what he called the cat and mouse game with revenue authorities. It's an intellectual challenge for him. Other people genuinely feel that they are doing social work and helping families. So one gentleman I interviewed in London said, look, I have a client. She's an elderly woman. And part of what I do is manage her wealth while she's in a nursing home. But a big part of what I do is I stand between her and her children who want to put her in a cheaper nursing home so that she'll die sooner and they'll inherit more money. There's nobody to stand up for her but me. And I have no financial interest in making sure that she gets the best care, because I don't make any more money if she does. I just think it's the right thing to do, and no one else will stand up for her on this.
Hmm. You know, the tax services industry also sounds like it does no favors in the far-flung places it sets up shop. Tell us your time doing research in the Cook Islands, which is a tax haven. You were robbed, and it was after you filed the police report. You had this really interesting conversation with a fisherman at the local port.
Good Lord, that place was a nightmare. I got robbed at this place called Pai Moana, which was supposedly this very nice, high-end property, and I was walking around near the beach in Rarotonga, and there was a fisherman cleaning some mahi-mahi, and I think he must have noticed that I was kind of upset-looking, and he said, what's wrong? And I explained what had happened, and he said, oh, yeah, that's why they call us the Crook Islands, and I hate what these finance industry people have done to my country.
The Crook Islands. So what would you say is the impact that these offshore banks have on local money, local culture, local economy?
Some people who have studied this even more widely than I have, the Tax Justice Network, they call it the finance curse. They say that these small countries that don't have a big economic base, they sign up to become offshore tax havens thinking it's going to be their salvation. And for a while, it usually works pretty well. But it tends to rot out the democracy and the social structure and the culture from the inside. And increasingly, we see that happening in places like Jersey and the British Virgin Islands. And according to this fellow, it's happening in the Cook Islands as well.
Brooke, these stories will make some people angry. They do highlight economic inequality in the world. But again, a lot of this is perfectly legal. And if these wealth managers' jobs is not just to advise about where and how to stash money, but to maintain a level of secrecy their clients expect, what is wrong with the system? Is it even fixable?
Usually the only individuals, say at the government level, who are empowered to change this, they themselves are so entrenched personally and organizationally in the system that they're hopelessly conflicted. They can't undo this because they lose personally, economically, but they also probably lose political power.
Brooke Harrington teaches at the Copenhagen Business School in Denmark. Really appreciate your time. Thank you, Brooke.
Thank you.
Long before the news broke about the Panama Papers, Ken Silverstein spent a year investigating the law firm in Panama at the center of it all, Mossack Fonseca. His conclusion? If shell companies are getaway cars for bank robbers, then Mossack Fonseca may be the world's shadiest car dealership. Silverstein is a contributing editor for Vice, and his investigation took him to Mossack Fonseca's offices in Panama City.
When I was down in Panama, I decided to stake out their office and see what it looked like. It's a four-story building. The first story is a dental clinic, and Mossack Fonseca operates in the top three stories. Mm. And there was a security guard, so I couldn't get into the building, but I was wandering by, and I thought I'd take a picture. So I pulled out my phone. I thought, being rather discreet, two women who worked for Mossack Fonseca looked at me, and it was like something out of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They just started screaming, he's taking a picture, he's taking a picture. So then I decided it was best to get out of the neighborhood. And yeah, in the end, they just, you know, they never talked.
You also wrote about how it was American banks that actually helped turn Panama into this financial center and a vibrant tax haven. How and when did that happen?
Panama emerged as a tax haven way back in the 70s, but the U.S. has had enormous influence on Panama since the country separated from Colombia, some would say at the direct behest of the United States under Theodore Roosevelt. And the country really grew up under American tutelage and became known as one of the world's premier offshore havens. And the entire economy is geared around banking secrecy and offering clients from abroad. You know, I mean, when I was there, there were 350,000 foreign companies registered in Panama. I mean, it's a huge number given the size of the country.
So all these shell companies, they're foreign. Where do they claim to base their headquarters? Like places like the British Virgin Islands or...
Mossack Fonseca, they could create companies for you anywhere. They actually turned the British Virgin Islands into one of the world's premier offshore havens beginning in the 1980s. And they've done it in various places around the world. There's a South Pacific island called Niue. And in the 1990s, they somehow, nobody knows exactly how, they got an exclusive contract to run the corporate registry in Niue. And suddenly Niue becomes the number one destination for South American drug cartels and Eastern European gangsters. I believe at the height, Niue had more shell companies than it did residents. But Mossack Fonseca, we know where it operated, but I mean, it's got to be millions and millions of shell firms that this company has set up. They are set up to do one thing. They hide money. They helped a lot of dirty people hide their money.
You know, your account of Bashar al-Assad's friend, Rami Maklouf, the richest man in Syria, he had a shell company in the British Virgin Islands, kind of alarming. His misdeeds actually prompted the U.S. to forbid American companies from doing business with someone as corrupt as him. And yet, today, when asked about this whole scandal, President Obama says tax avoidance is a big problem, but it's legal. Did you have anyone who explained to you how these two worlds can exist at the same time?
The global economy is seamlessly integrated into this offshore world. I mean, lots of people benefit from it. You know, wealthy individuals and companies either are evading or reducing their taxes legally through loopholes. It's a mistake to think of it as all illegal. I mean, the overwhelming majority of it is legal. I was sitting in my house and I created a shell company in Delaware over the phone.
Was this research?
Yeah, but I actually did it. It was research for the Vice piece. I called it MCSE. LLC, which was Medellin Cartel successor entity. And I just set this up over the phone. And then I went to Las Vegas and walked into an office of a firm. There were, you know, hundreds of these firms. You can find them in Las Vegas. And I set up a company called Sebastian Consulting LLC. Like, it took an hour. And that was named after my daughter's pet Siamese fighting fish.
Incredible.
It's, if you're a criminal or if you're just an average citizen who, for whatever reason, wants to set up an offshore account, you use the same mechanism, the same vehicle. You use the same companies, and that's the problem. There's a lot of hypocrisy. I mean, I remember when Obama took office, he was criticizing the Cayman Islands as a tax haven. And the Cayman Islands, their government came back and said, hey, what about you? What about – there's one address in Wilmington, Delaware that's home to like hundreds of thousands of shell companies. I mean, if you look at – reports on this topic, Delaware is one of the worst violators. Wyoming and Nevada as well. These states have rolled out the welcome mat in the same way that Panama has and the Cayman Islands and Malta and Singapore and other countries. Shutting down Mossack Fonseca or criminally charging them isn't really enough. Hopefully this is going to lead to actual law enforcement and rethinking of if we really want to allow people to just hide their money offshore. It's all too routine. It's just too easy.
Ken Silverstein, a contributing editor for Vice. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You might still be wondering how the Panama Papers actually affect you. We wondered too, so we sent our best data journalist to figure it out. You can see what he found at PRI.org. This is The World. 11 billion cubic meters, that's billion with a B. That's how much water the Mosul Dam in northern Iraq holds back. And Iraqi and American engineers alike are warning that the dam is at serious risk of failing. The dam was only recently wrested from ISIS control, but the locals still say, only half-jokingly, that the Mosul Dam is more dangerous than the Islamic State. Reporter Rebecca Collard talked to some of the people who live downstream.
Amina Mohammed has lived in the village of Wana on the banks of the Tigris River her whole life. She was here during the years of Saddam Hussein and the U.S. war. She even lived under ISIS. They surprised us one afternoon, she says, recalling the day ISIS swept into Wana in 2014. They just entered the village. Early last year, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters pushed ISIS out of Wana with the help of U.S. airstrikes. But a potentially bigger threat looms just 6 miles upstream. The deteriorating Mosul Dam, which is holding back billions of cubic meters of water. In February, the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad issued a warning to American citizens about the possibility of the dam's collapse, on top of its already stern warnings about travel to Iraq. I wasn't scared of the water before, Mohammed says, but then I heard the news about the dam, and now I'm terrified. Upstream at the dam, workers are doing maintenance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have to, just to keep it intact. The Mosul Dam isn't even that old. It was built in the early 80s, one of many grand infrastructure projects rolled out by Saddam and his Ba'ath Party. From the outset, there were problems. The riverbed here is composed of unstable soil and gypsum, a mineral that dissolves as water runs through it. In 2006, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers called it the most dangerous dam in the world. Now cracks form daily in the structure, requiring constant grouting to keep it from collapsing. Engineer Akil Mislim oversees the maintenance. His office is a big wood desk down a tunnel hundreds of feet inside the dam. Here, water pools on the floor. It takes 100 people, engineers and workers, he says, to keep the maintenance going. He says some cracks are small, but others take up to 50 tons of cement to fill. This maintenance is not optional, he says. But the work did stop for several months when ISIS seized control of the dam in 2014. They held it for less than 2 weeks, but even after Iraqi forces and Kurdish Peshmerga reclaimed the dam, it took months for the work to start up again. That may have created a permanent weakness in the structure, according to the U.S. government. Baghdad has signed a contract with an Italian team to help with emergency repairs. They're due to arrive later this month. But Akil Muslim and other Iraqi officials here say the U.S. warnings are overblown. The media tends to exaggerate, says Muslim, but we assure people everything is fine. U.S. officials don't see it that way, and in February they warned 500,000 to 1.47 million Iraqis who live along the Tigris probably would not survive a dam collapse. In Wana, people say the dam is now scarier than ISIS. If the dam does break, Wana would be the first inundated. Residents here don't have an evacuation plan. And while there are sensors on the dam, Wana is so close, they might have only minutes to flee if it did break. Kibia Jamil lives here with her husband and 7 children. She says they don't even have a car if they did need to escape. And leaving their village now isn't an option. We don't want to be displaced, says Jamil. And where would we go? She and others say they won't be pushed from their homes. Not by ISIS and not by this. For the world, Rebecca Collard, Wana, Northern Iraq.
Infrastructure has been on our minds lately here at The World, especially after last week's deadly collapse of an overpass in the Indian city of Kolkata. That overpass was made of concrete reinforced by steel bars, rebar. It's a mix used around the world for building. In the case of the Indian overpass, attention is mostly focused on the collapse of the steel structure. But how concrete is mixed and used around the world varies a lot. Just ask Robert Corland, the author of Concrete Planet.
Don't get me wrong, concrete is an essential building material for the modern world. But structures that were built up until the 1960s in the United States and until today in much of the third world is substandard.
Haven't things improved in terms of concrete safety in the modern age?
Well, yes. Because of the earthquakes we suffered since then, we've learned that, we need to add more rebar to the concrete. We need to do this and that. reinforced concrete has a limited lifespan. And the reason for that is that the steel reinforcing bars, the rebar in the concrete, will eventually corrode. And for instance, that's particularly true with building structures that are exposed to the elements, like, for instance, a highway overpass. Those have a structural lifespan of like 50 years. That's why our infrastructure is failing right now, is because we used a lot of concrete in the 1950s and from then on, but now it's all beginning to degrade. And
so
we've got to replace sewers, highways, and everything.
What you're saying, though, it's not the concrete that has a shelf life. It's the steel rebar in it that has the 50-year shelf life. So what is the better solution?
Well, one thing that we could do immediately that would make a big difference would be to mandate that all steel rebar be galvanized. In other words, it's covered in zinc, a fine layer of zinc. And that'll delay the corrosion process of the steel for at least a couple decades, maybe more. But right now, if you go to a typical building site and you see concrete being built, concrete structures being built, you'll notice that in many instances, the rebar has already started rusting. In other words, it's already got a head start. So we really have to change the way we build reinforced concrete structures. The Roman concrete structures are doing, you know, fine. The Pantheon in Rome, which is a magnificent building, is doing great. And that's because it doesn't have any steel in it.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, that's been there forever. Well, not forever, but a long time. You know, I don't want to draw any connection to the collapse of that flyover in India, but, I mean, we've seen so many building collapses and factory collapses in India, in Bangladesh. Is there something to be said about how concrete is used in these tragic cases? Because a lot of those buildings are pretty new.
Well, yes. Actually, India has some very, very good civil engineers, and I'm sure their building codes are up to Western standards. The trouble is that there's very little oversight on many building sites, and that's why we see problems with building collapses. And it's true all over the developing world.
Robert Corlin, the author of Concrete Planet, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Marco.
Later on the show, a town in England that's caught between a rock and a hard road, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Latinos in America have roots in many different countries and cultures.
That's why you can't really boil it down to the Latino vote or the Latino mind or the Latino anything in the U.S., you know?
Yep, we hear what Latino identity means, especially at election time. That's coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We in the news business like to say things like, such and such a candidate is courting the Latino vote. But that assumes that all Latinos think, feel, and vote the same way. The World's Maria Muriel has been reporting on the role of identity in this year's presidential elections as part of our Global Nation coverage. And Maria, that assumption is something you just wrote about at PRI.org, that myth that politicians and media often keep alive that Latinos vote with one mind or tend to prefer one candidate.
That's right. And they definitely don't. I've talked to a Nicaraguan immigrant who is a fervent Donald Trump supporter. And, you know, you would not expect that a Nicaraguan immigrant would be so in love with Donald Trump. She actually told me she loves Donald Trump. And now I just interviewed a man who is originally from Mexico. He was born to a Puerto Rican mother. So he's an American citizen by birth, but he's a Latino U.S. citizen, and he really loves Bernie Sanders. And he made a really good point why Latinos are kind of all over the spectrum when it comes to elections.
If you were part of the socialist agenda government that fell on September 11, 1973, to the coup of Augusto Pinochet, a socialist candidate might be very attractive. If you were a homosexual male who was imprisoned in some of the rehabilitation camps in Cuba during the 1970s, perhaps that word means something else.
Yes. Yeah, so what Luis Morentes was basically saying there is that when someone experiences when they were living in Latin America kind of informs who you may favor in elections here in the United States.
Right.
Morentes also told you about the cultural and political differences across all of Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, it's Central America, it's South America, it's the Caribbean. They're all very different cultures. And this is something that I can actually speak to personally. I'm from Peru. I grew up there. I was born there. I moved to Miami when I was 11 with my family. And pretty early on, I noticed the Latino community in Miami is different from the culture that I grew up with in Peru. I mean, we're on the Pacific coast. We have this like very strong Andean flavor. And in Miami, it's like very Caribbean. It's very Cuban. It's salsa. It's all very different things. That's why you can't really boil it down to the Latino vote or the Latino mind or the Latino anything in the U.S.
Can we generalize about what happens to Latin American immigrants in terms of how their identity evolves when they come to the U.S., like those changes?
Yeah, yeah. My grandmother came to visit last year from Peru, and I was telling her how I went to a conference and they had a session for journalists of color. And my grandma's like, wait, what do you mean of color? What color are you? And because, you know, I'm fair skinned as well. Like my family is white. So what happens to people across the spectrum of what Latino is when they migrate to the States is that you stop being just Peruvian or just Ecuadorian or just Cuban. You become a Latino. You become this ethnic minority, right? And I think Luis Morentes, the professor, I think he put it really well.
In my own personal background, when I was in Mexico in an upper middle class privileged family, male, I was a person. I became a Mexican Latino when I started studying in the university in Texas.
So I guess the generalization is that don't make assumptions.
Right.
So how do you identify yourself?
I have gone back and forth. I mean, I do strongly identify with my Peruvian roots. I'm very much from South America. I am an immigrant. And those are all of these things that I can be, and they're not mutually exclusive.
So given everything we've talked about and your reporting on this, Maria, what do you think Latino identity is in the U.S.? Is there something we can say about it?
I hate that I'm going to go for a cliche, but it's such a mosaic. I was talking with somebody about this recently. The closest thing that I could compare it to is like being Arab, you know, like the unifying thing is a language, but we come in many different skin tones, many different cultural identities, and many different ethnicities and religions. And as we're talking about these things, hopefully even presidential candidates and politicians begin to get this. Mm. Like you can't just vie for a demographic vote, because not all of the people in that group are going to behave the same way.
I got to say, it may be cliche, but what struck me in what you described about your arrival in Miami and the differences between Latinos you met there is that what united you is that you were now in the United States.
Yes.
And you're all American.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I mean, I like to say that I was American from when I was born. I was just in South America. And actually, 2/3 of Latinos, according to the Pew Research Center, believe that Latino is at least in part their race. I myself don't. I don't think that Latino can be a race. We come in so many different cultures, and my experience is not the same as an indigenous, as an Afro-Latino. But, you know, apparently 2/3 of American Latinos disagree with me. So I would love to hear from you guys if you're listening. We have on our Facebook group, the Global Nation Exchange, a discussion about this right now. So if you are a Latino hearing me right now and you think that I'm wildly wrong about any of this, go to Facebook and search Global Nation Exchange and leave me a comment there. I'd love to talk to you.
The World's Maria Muriel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to the fight in Syria. One of the reasons the U.S. has been reluctant to commit troops there is fear of American military casualties. Since it started deploying forces in Syria, Russia has had some of its own. This is a story of one of those Russian casualties. Alexander Prohorenko died on March 19th in the battle for the historic city of Palmyra. He was a forward air controller, which means he would ID targets and call in airstrikes. That much we know for sure. What's less clear is exactly how he died. Russian media have been reporting a heroic account of his end, so I asked journalist Natalia Antonova in Moscow to tell me more about Prohorenko.
Well, he was part of the Russian special forces, the Spetsnaz, as they're known in Russia. And he was a young man, 25 years old, from a very, very small village in the Orenburg region of Russia. He was very much well known to all of his neighbors, of course, just due to where he was from. And we don't know that much about him besides that. I mean, we have some pictures from social media, we know he was married and that he had a younger brother. And that's pretty much it.
So a real person, what happened to him according to Russian media?
Here's what we have to kind of go backwards. There's a new law in Russia that Putin signed pretty recently, and it says that any casualties during wartime are automatically a state secret. And when the state chooses, it releases the information. So automatically, we're dealing with a wall of secrecy surrounding this death. But what started happening is that actually Russian independent media reported on this. Dozhd TV, the only independent Russian news channel, reported that this man, you know, had died a hero. And that's when interest really started in this story. There is a transcript that some media have run with, including Dozhd, but also a lot of the pro-Kremlin media, that basically says that he was surrounded and he called in an airstrike to take out him as well as the people who had surrounded him, because he didn't want to be taken prisoner. He didn't want to be paraded. So he went ahead and called that airstrike in, and he died a hero. That's the story we're being told.
Calling the airstrike in on himself. He was in that position, yep. Surrounded
he
by
was
those
in that
ISIS
position.
Fighters.
Yep.
So are there any official transcripts of what happened, of what he was saying over the radio to his commanders?
We don't know if it's official or not, because once again, his death is technically a state secret. But we do have these transcripts that were released by Russian independent media as well as pro-Kremlin media that say that he said goodbye to his commander and wanted them to tell his family that he loved them. He said, tell them I was brave and I fought until I could no longer do anything. Please take care of my family, avenge my death. Goodbye, Commander. Tell my family I love them. So it's pretty gut-wrenching.
It is. If this is made up, or if big chunks of it are embellished, remind us why the Kremlin would want to do that.
Well, you know, it's very tough to figure out what exactly the Kremlin wants. You know, this is why it's so hard to figure out whether or not this is true. Because the Kremlin rules by signal, and then you have all this pro-Kremlin media that isn't explicitly told what to publish, but they do kind of want to please their masters. So on one hand, yes, it does seem like the sort of hero story that the Kremlin would approve of. On the other hand, because of the secrecy law and because of the fact that the Kremlin really, really does not want the public finding out about Russian military casualties, and one possibility, if this is not true, one possibility is that they knew that they were dealing with this leak of Russian casualties in Syria, and they decided, you know, well, maybe we can somehow embellish this to make it look good, at least. I don't know, though. It seems a bit too elaborate of a plan, frankly, to be fake or completely fake, but we have to question it, of course.
Is anyone in Russia asking how Prohorenko ended up isolated, alone, and unsupported? Like, where was backup?
I know that on some of the state TV, as well as Dozhd, they were talking about the fact that it's not that uncommon a practice for the Russian special forces. So we're talking about the best of the best. So it's not inconceivable that he would do this, and that also that he would end up alone. What his actual orders were, of course, we do not know.
Natalia, you're from a military family. How do you feel about this story?
I want to be able to take some solace from this story. I guess that's kind of my sense of it, because it's very hard with the secrecy, with the law on military deaths being declared a state secret and the huge layers of propaganda that we have around this war. It is very hard to separate fact from fiction. But you do know that a young man was killed, that he left behind a family who loved him. He left behind a wife. And he was actually, oddly, he's actually from the same region in Russia where my husband's from. And my husband also served in the military. They're not, thankfully, not in the special forces. I mean, I want to believe it. I do. When I question it, in the back of my mind, I'm also thinking, but I really want to believe this. I really want to believe he died a hero, because at least then it makes the death seem a little bit more okay.
Journalist and writer Natalia Antonova in Moscow, thank you very much for your time. Always great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Despite the headlines from around the globe that scream urgency, I gotta say I find it encouraging people can still focus on seemingly trivial matters, like a rock in the middle of the road in a small village northwest of London. It's been there for ages, but suddenly some people feel it's got to go. This rock is known as a Solbury Stone because it's in the village of Solbury. Pagans in the British Isles used to worship these standing stones. Apparently they still do. Mark Shaw joins me now. He's in charge of transport for the road where the Solbury Stone sits. Mark, tell us how big the stone is and where does it sit exactly?
Well, the stone actually sits in the centre of the road, and it's about the size of a small armchair. So it's quite sizable, about 3 foot by 4 foot. So it's quite easy to see, but it's quite a sizable feature.
Tell us what the point was of keeping the stone in the middle of the roadway low these many centuries ago.
Well, the reality is this stone is part of a huge boulder. Think of the stone that you can actually see as an ice cap. It travelled along the glaciers in the last ice age all the way from about 200 miles away, embedded itself with this piece of stone jutting out. When the village was built and the roads were built, the reality was that things were built around it. And the stone has become the true real heart and lifeblood of the community there.
And for the residents, it's never been a problem. They know it's there. It's just part of their life, and that's been fine.
Everyone knows it's there. It's a historical spot. People come to visit it and to see it. And as you pointed out, pagans come and worship there as well. And it's never been an issue until recently.
Yeah, what happened? A little car accident, huh?
A car reversed and went into the stone and then sent my council a bill for £1,800. We sent one of our engineers to have a look and see what the issue was. He initially thought that maybe one of the things that we may have to do is to remove the stone. I have to say, as soon as I heard about it, which was Tuesday of last week, I just turned around and said, it's lunacy. That stone's been there for some 11,000 years. To think of moving it would be just absolute madness.
Just because somebody backed up their car into the stone?
Well, you know, one accident in 11,000 years, you've got to give the stone a bit of weight there, haven't you?
Was it a local who did this or an out-of-towner?
It was an out-of-towner, I believe. So, you know, it just shows that when you're driving, always keep your eyes open, especially for larger rocks in the road.
Yeah, for sure. So the public in Solbury, I gather, did not like the suggestion of taking the stone out. How did they respond?
Well, clearly they were very upset. Some even threatened to chain themselves to the stone. As I said, as soon as I heard about it, I said, no, this isn't going to happen. I went down and I visited the village the very next day and met with local residents and discussed the issue. And we just used a bit of good old British common sense and said, well, look, let's look at ways that we can make this slightly safer and more secure for people who use the road, especially for out-of-towners. And, we'll bring some common sense to this.
So what are you going to do to make it safe for drivers?
I've got some engineers going down tomorrow. I think we're going to deal with it in a very sympathetic way. Look at putting some lining maybe around the stone just to make people more aware when they drive into the road that there is an obelisk there. But at the end of the day, if you can't see a larger stone, there has to be some question marks as to whether you should be driving, I guess.
Really? Take away your license. I was thinking maybe put up a sign that says, get over it, but then you might have some out-of-towners who would actually try to drive over the stone.
Maybe in a tank, but I'm told that in the Second World War, two tanks tried to remove the stone and couldn't, so it shows it's got some strength and depth.
No kidding. Mark Shaw, in charge of transport for the road where the famous Solbury Stone sits and will continue to sit. Mark, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. Canadians speak two languages, right? English and French. True, but oh, if it were only that easy. Each Canadian province can choose which language to speak officially. There's only one province that's chosen to be officially bilingual, New Brunswick on the Atlantic coast, bordered by Quebec and the U.S. state of Maine. And in one area of New Brunswick, language gets even messier. That's where people speak Shak, a French dialect that includes a bunch of English words. We sent Emma Jacobs on a road trip to eastern Canada to find out why Shak gets such a complicated reception.
At the laundromat in the city of Moncton, people sitting around the bar and wooden tables chat in French or in English. In Moncton, Canada's two languages come together in a very noticeable way. About two-thirds of the population grew up speaking English, a third French. Often a particular kind of French, as explained by the table of girls in the back corner.
Shak is weird. Like, we would take English words, like, let's say I'm driving, Well, in French, we're going to say j'ai drive.
That's the English verb drive, conjugated like a French verb, j'ai drive. That was Caroline Savoie, and here's her friend, Marianne Cuisson.
We add a French twist to the English words, so that's what makes it Chiac.
Chiac includes words from Old French and the indigenous language Mi'kmaq, but it's best known for borrowing English words and phrases. Savoie, a 22-year-old up-and-coming local musician, explains that comes naturally growing up here.
It goes back from my parents' time. Like, even when our parents were little, I don't even think it was officially bilingual, like the province. Like, and there was like a huge tension.
That tension dates way back before her parents were born. This area of eastern Canada was once French Acadia. It was ceded to the British, who in 1755 deported 10,000 Acadians to France and other English colonies. Many came back, but found English and English speakers now predominated. English was the main language of the streets and of government right through the 1960s. Student protesters in Moncton in the late 60s heard here from the documentary L'Acadie, L'Acadie. They demanded recognition for the French minority and public services in their language. In 1969, they got the Official Languages Act, adding French to English as an official language of the province. It might seem paradoxical, but it's around that same time of pro-French activism that some people around here started to claim their way of talking, Chiac, with some pride. Even though the world of French to this day has a real emphasis on speaking a standard version of the language, Chiac, with its Acadian accent and mix of English, is seen as really far out there. Savoie experienced this when she appeared on the French version of The Voice in 2014. She sang in French, but her Chiac-speaking bits were subtitled on TV in France.
Mademoiselle Caroline Savoie, le 13, par SMS, 72-500.
On the show, I'm the only one they subtitled. There were people from Quebec on the show. I was the only Acadian, and they didn't subtitle the Quebecers.
But she's mostly laughing about it. Well, some people in French Canada would not. Another local musician, Lisa LeBlanc, has become controversial in other parts of Canada for her Chiac lyrics. This is her song, J'suis pas un cowboy.
J'irai chercher ton cœur si tu l'emportes ailleurs, même si dans tes danses, d'autres dansent déjà.
LeBlanc sold lots of albums in Quebec, but also gotten critical reviews there. The thing is, Chiac falls right in the middle of a long political fight over language in Canada. Some French speakers feel the need to protect pretty aggressively against the ubiquity of English. This is mostly associated with Quebec. In language terms, this means people there reject English words adopted outright in France. In Paris, a stop sign reads stop, but in Montreal, the red octagon says arrête. If there's a symbol of New Brunswick's linguistic coexistence and slightly more relaxed attitudes, it's probably the bilingual stop sign, stop above arrête. And at least some people think the linguistic equivalent of that stop sign might sound something like Chiac. But some people still feel a little conflicted about this way of treating the French language.
It sort of pains me deep inside, but it's also there.
France Daigle is one of the region's best-known writers in French. Her characters often speak in Chiac.
As a writer, using words as a material, it sort of became fun and interesting to work with this sort of hybrid language. Now, is it dangerous? You know, it's like those other things, you know, drugs and sex. And, you know, it's sort of fun, but is it dangerous?
Daigle thinks a lot about the acceptable range of Chiac, how much English is too much. She has a day job at a call center and describes a conversation she recently overheard between two coworkers. One described her home construction in Chiac, with almost all English nouns.
Tile washer, pile dryer. But dans la cuisine, j'ai mis un double sink.
Daigle's a little concerned, but also intrigued. Perhaps her colleague is discussing the construction at home with an English-speaking husband, and that's what's coming out.
There's something of the human spirit going into this use of the language, and if it works, and if we're understood, and we're communicating. It's not all beautiful, but it's a way of... So I don't know. I really don't have answers. I have more questions than answers.
But another way that Chiac is a little like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, these questions are most pressing for parents. Timo Richard is better known as a Shiak musician than a dad. He's a former member of the hip-hop group Radio Radio. Now he has two daughters, Maggie and Stella. And it may come as a surprise to fans, but he tries not to use much Shiak around them. He wants them to have the ability to work in French, which means standard French people outside New Brunswick will understand. His daughters are getting English everywhere else. School, the internet, TV. So now every conversation he has with the older one in particular, they're negotiating over language.
She'll be talking in French and, ah, papa, j'ai entendu dire qu'il y avait un nouveau jouet qui sortait. Puis, il est pretty awesome. Pretty awesome?
Now, when she says things like that, it's not about what language she can speak, but which she chooses to.
It's just to be cool.
She's a little young to be listening to her father's Shiak music, but he and the other performers arguably contribute something else on this front. That is, encouraging young French speakers to keep speaking French by making Shiak cool, something young people can play with and be proud of as a local trademark, a way of belonging to their own special club. It's French, but with a little more cachet. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs in Moncton.
For the full-on Shiak experience, including how to order a Café Americano to go in Shiak, check out our podcast, The World in Words. You can listen at iTunes or pri.org/language.
Au pire, on rit ensemble. On mange du Kraft dinner. C'est tout ce qu'on a besoin.
That's Shiak singer Lisa LeBlanc ending our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.